Chapter 23. Settlement, 4 months ago. No phone call or high-res video could take the place of standing in front of Aunt Rochelle and talking to her. So that's what Ray would do. Now he was half-sitting, half-leaning on the hood of her car, hands jammed into the pockets of his puffy coat. He'd been standing outside her Philadelphia condo, waiting for her since 7 a.m., he knew she sometimes left early for work. At about 7:40, she came into sight. When she saw him, her shoulders lifted and her head rocked back on her neck, her body language projecting surprise at seeing some black dude sitting on the hood of her car. Her hand came up to her throat. Then she recognized him. "Ray?" "Hi, Aunt Rochelle."
"Oh, my Lord. You gave me a fright," she said.
She bounded forward and hugged him tightly. The hood of her car jammed into the back of his leg.
"What are you doing here, sugar? You okay?"
"I wasn't sure if you'd talk to me," he said, hugging her back, breathing in her familiar perfume. "So I figured I'd just show up and say hello."
"Not talk to you," she said. "Why wouldn't I talk to you? Because of all that foolishness with your violin?"
She shook her head.
"I don't know where their heads are sometimes, and that's the God's truth. Of course I'll talk to you. How are you? What's been going on? It's been forever since I've seen you, except on TV."
She hugged him again. He started telling her about the concerts, about playing all over the country, about the media interviews. She cut him off.
"You know, I'm not going to stand out here in the cold and listen to my favorite nephew, who just happens to be a famous musician. We're going for breakfast. Have you eaten? Don't you have to go to work?"
"Screw him," she said cheerfully.
"I feel his sudden sore throat coming on. Hold on a sec."
She pulled out her phone, tapped an email.
"I got some sick days coming anyway. Where you want to go for breakfast? There's a Bob Evans down the street that makes a mean sausage biscuit."
Ray had forgotten Aunt Rochelle's love of biscuits.
"That sounds great," he said.
She drove, her car immaculate, with a lemony air freshener that surprisingly did not smell like some kind of chemical spill.
"Tell me everything," she told him. "I can't believe I'm sitting here with my world-famous musician nephew," she said.
She looked in the rearview mirror,
and a billion-dollar violin in the back seat.
So he talked, in the car and in Bob Evans as they sat in the booth and ordered. It had been months, he realized, since he'd had a conversation with someone in his family. And family really was special. The relationships were unlike any other. Fraught and perilous much of the time, but sweet as well. He told her about touring, about Baton Rouge, about Christoph, about performing in huge concert halls and in school gyms. In the meantime, they wolfed down eggs and biscuits with bacon and vegan sausage. The waitress brought over more orange juice for Ray and refilled Rochelle's coffee. She cleared their plates.
"You see this handsome man here?" Rochelle told her. "He's a famous musician. He was on 60 Minutes last month."
"Aw, jeez, come on, Auntie," Ray said, embarrassed. The waitress, hands full with dirty plates, was properly appreciative. After she left, Rochelle said,
"Speaking of 60 Minutes, what's going on with those people? The ones who said they used to own Pop-Pop's Fiddle?"
"That's one of the reasons I wanted to meet you," Ray said. "I had to hire a lawyer to fight them and, well, the family." Up until now, neither had directly acknowledged the family's lawsuit against Ray, of which Rochelle wasn't part.
"I can't tell you how sorry I am about all this," she said now. "It wasn't my idea. I told them that Mama wanted you to have that violin, and it was criminal to say otherwise. Mama would be turning over in her grave if she knew."
"Yeah," Ray agreed.
"I think she would." It's really rough. And now that they have this lawsuit, I can't even talk to them, which makes this next part harder. My lawyer asked me to see if I can get any information about how Pop-Pop got the violin to begin with. Rochelle stared down at the tabletop, then up at Ray. Mama's the only one who really knew, but seances aren't admissible in court, she said with a laugh. So getting an affidavit from Mama won't really help. I asked Jean and Rita, Ray said, referring to distant cousins, but they weren't even born then and didn't know anything. The thing is, he went on, I actually may have found something. He told her about the big clasped envelope with the name Leon Mark scrawled across it that he'd found in his grandmother's attic. I remember where I found it. It was in a yellow dresser that was wedged under the roof in the back right corner. I asked Aunt Joyce about it a couple months ago, and she said she'd check in Grandma Nora's other papers, but I never heard back from her. And now I can't ask her directly. I'd really like to see what was inside that envelope. Did you open it? I think so, he said uncertainly. I honestly don't remember. I was looking for a fiddle. I think I remember seeing some folded up paper, but I could have invented all that by now. I have no idea where it would be, she said. She reminded him of how, a few months after Nora's death, the five siblings had met in Georgia to go through the house, picking out what they wanted, selling or donating or throwing away what they didn't. She didn't remember seeing any envelope, but the house had been packed with 60 years' worth of family life, and she'd seen only a portion of it. I thought Joyce had all the paperwork, but I can ask everybody for you. They won't be very cooperative. But if the Marx's lawsuit goes away, then I guess maybe their own lawsuit has a better shot. He laughed humorlessly. I don't have to tell them it's for you. I can say I was just curious. That would be awesome, he said. Thank you. Do you know who bought her house? No idea. We just hired a realtor and sold it. But if you're thinking we left stuff up in the attic, you can think again. I know Thurston and your mom spent days up there, dragging everything out. I think your mama was convinced there were family jewels hidden in the walls. We ended up hiring a dumpster and throwing almost all of it away. The house was totally empty when we sold it. He had a mental image of that yellow dresser lying on its side, green eyes staring up at the sky, surrounded by moth-eaten winter coats and old Stevie Wonder albums. Rochelle and Ray talked for another 20 minutes or so, then finally slid out of the booth. What are you up to today? She asked. Just wanted to see you, he said, slinging the violin onto his shoulder. I'm leaving for Des Moines tonight, but my flight doesn't leave until 6 o'clock. Good, she said. Let's play hooky. Let's go to Reading Terminal Market and wander around the city some. I never get to go places like that, and I've been wanting to. She eyed his violin. Are you taking that everywhere? He shrugged. When I'm traveling, I don't leave it behind. The case is indestructible, and honestly, I don't even notice it anymore. Okay, well, we'll make a tourist out of that fiddle, she said. They spent the day wandering around central Philly, the stalls and great food of the Reading Terminal Market, down into Chinatown, over to the Liberty Bell. They were crossing Franklin Square when Aunt Rochelle nudged him and pointed with her chin. Look, look, she said. What? What's wrong? Look at her, she said. Don't you think she's cute? A young athletic woman was crossing in front of them, her toned ass bouncing with every step in her black leggings. She had her hands jammed into the pockets of her red puffy coat, hair pulled back in a ponytail. She wore red earmuffs. What? She's aight. I give you a dollar to talk to her. He stopped in the middle of the street. Are you serious? I'm not doing that. I have a girlfriend. Now it was her turn to stop. What? When did you find a girlfriend? We've been together for a while now. You have? How long? You have a picture? Let me see. I can't believe you didn't tell me you got a girlfriend. So he told her about Nicole, how they met, how often they could see each other. Relaxing and chatting with his aunt was the most fun he'd had in weeks. He was sad when she drove him back to her condo to pick up his rental car to head out to the airport. But they promised to be in closer touch. It was a good day. A few days later, true to her word, Aunt Rochelle emailed Ray. Hey, sugar. Still thinking about that Philly cheesesteak I got at Central Market. I need to find an excuse to go back again, LOL. So I asked all the sibs about any paperwork, and they all said they'd look. Your mama kept asking why, and I told her I was curious about family history. Not sure if she believed me or not, but we'll see what they come up with. A week later. Just wanted to give you an update, which is no news. Joyce did have Mama's and Daddy's birth certificates, but nobody can find anything about Pop-Pop. They promised me they'd keep looking, but they think they probably threw it out. 2 weeks later. Sorry, sugar, nothing new to report. They say they don't have anything. When you coming back to Philly? There's a new restaurant that opened near me, and I want to take you. He called Kim Wok, told her how he'd reached out to his cousins, and they knew nothing about Leon Marks and the violin. Told her how his Aunt Rochelle had asked his family to see if they'd seen the envelope, and how they told her they hadn't. The thing is, he said, I don't know how hard they looked. I seriously doubt my Uncle Larry or my mom would even bother looking, even if they did have it. There's nothing in it for them, so they won't bother lifting a finger. And then Ray told her his plan, a stroke of genius that killed two birds with one blow. His plan would resolve his family's issues and get him that missing envelope. Kim Wok did not think it was a stroke of genius. That is the dumbest thing I've ever heard, she told him. You are seriously not going to do this. He ignored her. A week later, in a Sheraton outside the Baltimore-Washington International Thurgood Marshall Airport, Ray seated himself at the head of a conference table, his back to the brown vertical blinds, a sheet of paper with his notes in front of him. He'd arranged with the hotel staff for two video screens, and he booted up both. On the first was Kim Wok, his lawyer. On the second was Colin Hanzo, who collectively represented his family except for Aunt Rochelle, in the lawsuit against him. En masse, his mother and her siblings poured into the room. No significant others or kids. Aunt Rochelle, who didn't have to be there but wanted to back him up, hugged him. Uncle Larry shook Ray's hand, told him he looked good. The others nodded and smiled insincerely. His mother glared at him from the far end of the table. Thank you for coming, Ray said. I hope you all had good flights or drives in. I know how bad the traffic can be. I tried to find a place that was central for all of you. Would have just been better to pick someone's house and we all could go there, said his mother. I got to pay for a hotel room tonight. She dressed up for the occasion in a tight salmon-colored dress with fake nails and lipstick to match. He ignored her. Anyway, I have a proposal for you, and I wanted to talk to you about it in person. Ray? Kim Wok cut in from the video monitor. Can I just say for the record that I think this is a terrible idea? He ignored her, too. I'd like to settle the issue of Pop-Pop's fiddle. Kim here, he nodded at the screen, says that if you end up actually going to court and not just writing me threatening letters, that the case will get thrown out as frivolous and that you'll have to pay her attorney fees. She thinks you're doing all this because you want me to settle and you want to make some money, even if you don't have a good claim to my violin. He took a breath, waiting for a contradiction. but no one spoke. Let me start by saying that there is no way that I'm getting rid of Pop-Pop's fiddle. Grandma gave it to me. It was important to her and to this family, and it's going to stay with me. If I have kids someday, I'll pass it down to them. But I do want to settle this, and I want us to be a family again. I also got accepted to compete in the Tchaikovsky competition, which is pretty much the biggest competition in the world. I need to be able to practice without all these distractions. So here's my proposal. When I'm done talking, I'll leave the room and let all of you talk to your lawyer and figure out if you want to do it. Just know that this is the only settlement offer I'll be making. If you go to court and lose, you won't be getting anything. And you'll be stuck with Kim's attorney's fees, too, which are pretty steep, let me tell you. Here's what I'm offering. He looked down at his notes, looked back up. Starting next year, I will pay each of you $100,000 over the next 10 years. That's $500,000 total. I know you think that's nothing to me, but let me tell you, for a working musician, it's a lot of money. I'll also list the five of you as the primary beneficiaries of the violin's insurance policy in case something happens to the violin. But let me be super clear here. If the violin gets damaged or stolen, or if I get injured in any way, and if there's the slightest evidence that any of you or any of your friends or relatives are involved, you'll get absolutely nothing. And to make sure this happens, the insurance company will be instructed to hold the money in escrow for 5 years, so you won't see an immediate payday if something happens to the violin. So it'd be better for you if you kept me alive. He smiled. Nobody else did. This is the last thing. I want all papers from Leon Marks, from Pop-Pop. I know there was an envelope that had some papers in it. I found it in the attic and gave it to Grandma, but I don't know what happened to it. So if by June 1st you find that envelope, or those papers, I'm willing to give you all another $500,000 that you can split however you want. So that's my offer, he said, standing and folding the paper with his notes on it. His hands were shaking, but he clenched them into fists. $1 million in cash, and you're listed as beneficiaries on the insurance. Think about it and let me know. I'll be outside in the lobby. And he walked out the door. 15 minutes later, they texted him to come back. They would take his offer. Within the next 2 weeks, the lawyers wrote it all up in nice legalese, and the deal was done. Ray heard later that his family tore their houses apart looking for documents about Leon Marks. They contacted the Georgia Historical Society, the ACLU, and everywhere else they could think of. They knocked on the door of Grandma Nora's old house, went up to the now barren attic, pounded on the walls, and searched the insulation. But Leon Marks's papers had disappeared, probably thrown out with so much of Grandma Nora's life. Chapter 24. Theft. In the meantime, the Tchaikovsky competition, slated for mid-June, was bearing down upon him. Practice and lessons dominated Ray's life. Both Ray and Janice had their own thoughts about his strengths and weaknesses. The trick was to find teachers who not only could build on his strengths and improve his weaknesses, but who also had the availability and the willingness to teach him. Janice had pulled many strings, and the strings of strings, because that was how the game was played, and she was good at it. From January to June, Ray would divide his life into three blocks. In the first, he'd focus on Bach and Ravel. In the second, on Mozart, Chrysler, and Paganini. And finally, in the few weeks before the competition began, on Tchaikovsky. Once a week, Ray would fly to take a lesson with the instructor, then fly home to practice. Money would be very tight for the next 6 months. It was a big gamble, and Ray hoped it would pay off. By early January, he'd finalized his schedule and it was grueling. Block one was with Rachel Vetter in Chicago. He'd already met her briefly when he played with the Chicago Symphony and focused on the Bach Chaconne and Ravel's Zigan. She was considered one of the foremost Bach experts in the country. Ray had once heard her perform the Zigan and was completely astounded at how she balanced power and precision. Such a petite person playing so fiendishly well, as though she summoned gypsy spirits when her bow touched the string. Rachel drilled him on the Bach and the Zigan for 5 hours at a time, and then he flew home and practiced until his brain and fingers gave way. He practiced so much that he began making simple mistakes. Miscounting, playing wrong notes, ignoring accidentals. This was a sure sign that he was beginning to overdo it. His brain was experiencing serious fatigue. Every week or so, Nicole would fly down to Charlotte. She was a virtuoso with flights and found the cheapest offerings possible, so that meant she was often showing up on Ray's doorstep at 2 a.m. or leaving for the airport at 4 a.m. March and early April were slated for Block 2 with Ben Amundsen in Los Angeles, who focused on Mozart, Kreisler, and Paganini. Amundsen was heralded for his interpretation of Mozart concertos and sonatas. He was also a very good friend of Janis's, so that was an easy choice to make. In Charlotte, between lessons, Ray buried himself in the music, with a strict practice routine that didn't vary. Up at 7 a.m. for breakfast and a quick workout, then at 9:30, an hour of scales and arpeggios, starting off with every major and minor scale, using several different bowings, focusing on making each scale a work of art, and then on to harmonic, melodic, and natural minor arpeggios, concentrating on the fingerings and the bowings. At 11 o'clock, he'd start in on Mozart, his long fingers effortlessly jumping into the intricacy, like a puzzle he'd manipulate in the air. Since he'd worked on these pieces with Janis when he was in college, he'd sometimes stop and call, ask her about a specific fingering. If she wasn't teaching, they'd sometimes do a video call, and she'd watch him, critiquing as he went. No later than 1 p.m., he would turn to the Paganini Caprices numbers 24 and 6. These pieces worried him. They were in the compulsory round of the competition, and he'd have to do something to stand out. Janis suggested that he play them at lightning speed, so he was trying hard to do that. At 2 p.m., he'd drill into the simple, beautiful Valse Scherzo in C major by Tchaikovsky. Even though he'd be focusing on it during Block 3, he still wanted to play it every day, since that way, even his muscles would follow and anticipate the flow of the competition. Besides, he just liked playing it. 3 p.m., and time for a late lunch. He was always starving. If he and Nicole were in different cities, he'd give her a call, and her voice would pour out, warm and honey gold, making a knot loosen in his chest. How is practice going? Okay, the scherzo feels better. I think I got a handle on it. I love the way you play that piece. It's like Tchaikovsky wrote it for you. It felt pretty good at the end. Of course it does. Now get back to it. You have a competition to win. After lunch, he drilled into Mozart and Kreisler for the next 3 hours, playing each piece from beginning to end, as if in a concert performance. Before he knew it, 10 p.m. had barreled past, and he staggered into the shower and bed. In May, only a month before the competition, Leonid Molchalin, one of the world's foremost Tchaikovsky authorities, had deigned to bestow his insights upon Ray. Molchalin's teaching schedule at Juilliard meant that he would be available only once school was out, in mid-May. Ray would stay in New York to work with him. Later, the FBI and Alicia Childress would tell him that his regimented schedule made it easier for the thieves to track him, so he could blame himself for his own stupid predictability. But on May 16th, the day of the theft, Ray was still pointlessly unaware, still believed that a strict schedule would help him. He'd practice 10 to 12 hours a day minimum, with lessons in the late morning every other day. He wanted to practice more, but physically he knew he couldn't. Carpal tunnel syndrome could kick in, or tendonitis. It wasn't worth taking the risk. May 15th, a month before he was slated to fly to Moscow, was Ray and Nicole's last full day in Manhattan. The morning schedule would be identical to the previous 5 days. Only the late afternoon and evening would be different. A celebration of his last lesson. They were scheduled to leave New York the following day. So he woke that morning before the 6 a.m. alarm, crept out of the room, down to the hotel gym, and worked out for an hour. When he returned at 7, Nicole was awake. He poured the last bowl of cereal, drizzled the little bit of milk that was left in the hotel refrigerator, and then practiced till 8:30. He slid the violin back into its case, kissed Nicole goodbye, and headed out into the Manhattan morning. Commuters in long tan overcoats swam along the sidewalks, staring at their phones. Garbage trucks roared past. He headed down 53rd, turned up 7th Avenue toward Lincoln Center and Juilliard. One of Leonid Molchalin's earliest teachers actually studied with Adolf Brodsky, who worked with Tchaikovsky himself on the famous violin concerto. Russian-born, with decades of experience as a performer and a teacher, Molchalin had been a student of Ivan Galamian and Isaac Stern, and a member of the Moscow Philharmonic Orchestra. It was pure luck and a lot of Janis pulling strings that Leonid agreed to meet with Ray, and they only had a few weeks together. Molchalin was heading to Europe soon to play with the Royal Stockholm Philharmonic Orchestra. Now above Ray loomed Juilliard's dramatic steel and glass. Inside, he breathed in its aroma of pine sol and air conditioning. Most students were gone, and the halls echoed as he ascended to the practice rooms on the second floor. He started warming up. Leonid, a short man in jeans and a shapeless dark green polo shirt, arrived a few minutes later. On this final morning of Ray's lessons with Leonid, they practiced the Tchaikovsky concerto over and over again, Leonid drilling Ray on the interpretation in the third movement. Finally, Leonid nodded. "From now on, you must just practice and make it your own. Even more your own. Your sound is very pure. Very Russian." Very Russian. It didn't get better than that. Ray packed up the violin, slung it over his shoulder, headed out and down 65th to Central Park, weaving past bicyclists and a waffle stand towards 7th Avenue, and then back to the hotel. It was 1:30 p.m. Nicole reappeared around 2 o'clock. She'd been shopping for her niece, whose birthday was next week, and set her packages down just inside the door. She kicked off her shoes and lay back on the bed, listening to him play or reading her novel or both. A little after 3 p.m., he set the violin back in its case and spooned with Nicole on the bed for an hour, exhausted, the music of Tchaikovsky and Mozart in his veins. He got up and practiced again until just after 6 p.m. Then, a little after 6, he later told the investigators between 6:05 and 6:15 p.m., he put the violin back in its case for the last time, closed the clasps, put the case on the bureau below the TV, where he always set it. He shucked off his t-shirt and jeans, padded naked into the bathroom for a shower before dinner. Nicole, who'd showered, was right outside, putting on her makeup in the bathroom mirror. They were meeting Leonid Molchalin and his partner Gary Broussard, a science writer for the New York Times, for dinner on the Upper West Side. They would rather have taken the subway, cheaper and faster during rush hour, but Ray was always very conscious of the violin and would rather take a car instead. If he had only taken the subway, despite his own instincts. Dinner at a fancy Indian restaurant. Ray sat on the banquette, his back to the room, violin next to him. They talked about music, of course, and the Tchaikovsky competition, and Gary held forth about some theories about what gave the Stradivarius its unique sound. Some thought it wasn't the wood or the perfect proportions, but actually the varnish that coated the instrument. Ray, several glasses of wine in, asserted that it was none of those physical characteristics, that Antonio Stradivari had magically, somehow managed to imbue his instruments with a life of their own, with soul. They could laugh at him all they wanted, but he was convinced of this. His violin was vastly more than the sum of its parts. The four of them together polished off three bottles of wine. They were musicians, okay? Everyone knew musicians liked to drink, as well as assorted cocktails, so that when they staggered out into the balmy May night, the streetlights spun slightly, and Leonid barely avoided a delivery guy biking on the sidewalk without headlights. "Watch it, buddy!" Gary yelled after the cyclist, who zoomed off, unconcerned. Ray couldn't remember ever being parted from the violin case the entire time they were at the restaurant. He did indeed take it with him when he went to the bathroom twice. The police and CCTV further confirmed the route they took after dinner to an Irish pub on the corner of 83rd and Columbus, where Ray tucked himself into a booth, the violin in the corner, and where they continued to drink until almost midnight, when Ray and Nicole caught a cab south to the hotel. No, he didn't open the case when he was out at the restaurant, or the bar, or in the cabs. At least he didn't think so. Had he opened it back in the hotel? There was that one bit of fingering that Leonid kept drilling him on. Had he practiced briefly before putting the violin back? He'd had too much to drink. He didn't think he'd opened the case. He wasn't sure. He never locked it when it was with him. It was always with him. The keys to the lock were on his keychain. He had his keychain. The case had not been locked when he opened it in Charlotte. The next morning, they woke after 7 a.m. Both their flights were around 11 o'clock, so they ordered room service, and a woman named Pilar Jimenez set out their breakfast on the small dining room table, inches from his unopened violin case. She left, they ate, they packed, they took cabs to the airports, Nicole flying out of Newark to Erie, and Ray heading to Charlotte via LaGuardia. That afternoon, back in Charlotte, he'd opened the violin case for the first time in 24 hours, and instead of his violin, found only a white Chuck Taylor tennis shoe and a ransom note. How do you remember to keep breathing when the most important piece of your life, a violin-shaped marvel that defines who you are, that organizes your day, that completes you as a human being, is stolen? How do you keep the blood moving in your veins? How do you make sure your eyes blink, your throat swallows? You just do. You lie on your bed for hours. You pull out the layman that you have to practice on. You try to recapture the magic of music, the emotion of the moment, the days and weeks of practicing. You try because, after all these years of practicing, you're hardwired to try. The world swims in unreality, and for a moment, you believe that your violin is in its case. You only have to open it. The next moment, reality crushes you. The case is empty, miles away in some police warehouse somewhere. This happens all day, 40 or 50 or 200 times, opening a door or pouring a bowl of cereal or flushing the toilet. A knock on the door is someone returning the violin. No, it's the mailman with a Bath & Body Works coupon. You open your closet and expect to see a violin hanging from a hook or propped on a shelf. You turn on your TV and anticipate that the newscaster will talk not about the latest stock market updates, but about a violin miraculously restored to its owner. You convince yourself that you're going to get it back. But the voice that tells you you're going to get it back is also the voice that tells you, a half breath later, that you'll never see it again. No matter what anyone says, no matter how often your girlfriend hugs you and holds you, No matter how many bouquets of flowers or teddy bears fans send you, or casseroles that your beloved mentor, friend, and teacher drops off, it doesn't matter. It doesn't help. The teddy bears pile up in a corner, and you throw a sheet over them so you don't have to encounter their accusatory glares, them telling you that it's gone. It can't be gone. It was just here. It's gone. Because here is the heart of it. It wasn't about the money or the prestige of playing a Stradivarius or the looks people gave him, envious and impressed, when they learned who he was and what the violin had been. His loss had nothing to do with any of these things, and the wealth and fame were distractions that he shrugged off. Here is what he realized in the gray shadows of his 3 a.m. vigils. He was alone now. He was desperately, terribly alone. Until then, he'd been a solitary, lonely kid, and then a solitary, lonely man, who had had one special person in his life, dressed in a pink housecoat and smelling of lavender and bluing solution in her hair. She had gone, but she had given him music, and music had filled his world, had allowed him to connect with people in a way that he sometimes could not believe could ever be real. But now she was gone, and the violin had gone, and the music had gone, and he felt so lonely and guilty now that he often thought the misery would paralyze him, and he would simply, suddenly stop breathing under the weight of it. He obsessed over who could have taken it. After the initial flurry of police activity, the FBI did not call that often. Alicia's texts pinged his phone less frequently. The updates only trickled in. So he pushed them all, Bill Soames and Alicia Childress and the NYPD, to investigate every lead. Nicole was convinced it was his family who wanted their half of the insurance money and figured it would be better to wait the agreed-upon 5 years for it rather than have Ray dole out their money in tinier increments. Ray, however, was convinced that it was the Marks family. They were crazy. They were also unscrupulous and obsessed with the violin. They seemed less interested in money and more interested in owning the violin itself, or in punishing Ray for his existence. The only thing that made him doubt his own theory was the ransom. The Marks family would have no intention of returning the violin for whatever price. But perhaps that too was part of their plan, to take the violin and an extra $5 million. He wouldn't put it past them. Chapter 25. Day 17. Raising Money and Hope. Here was the thing that Ray knew about himself. He was hardwired not to give up. The violin was gone, and its loss paralyzed him. But paradoxically, its loss also spurred him to control the two areas in his life that he could control, practicing his ass off and raising money for the ransom. By the last week of May, he had resumed his regular practice schedule, up at 6 a.m., exercising and beginning practice by 7. Every morning, he'd awake and expect the violin to be returned, and every day its loss punched him like a bowling ball to the face, but he would draw a breath, or two or three, and reach for the layman. More than ever, he would not let the loss destroy him. He could still make music. He could still stand tall. He could still be worthy of respect. He'd practice maniacally until early afternoon, until his legs wouldn't hold him or his fingers had gone numb. Then he'd grab another bowl of cereal. Cereal was pretty much all he was eating these days, and open his laptop. He spent every afternoon trying to raise $5 million. 6 days in, his crowdfunding campaign had raised a whopping $143,228. "That's an awesome beginning," Nicole told him that afternoon on the phone. They were both in their respective cars, she driving to a last-minute substitute performance in Cleveland, and he and Charlotte heading over to meet Wells Fargo's wealth management team to discuss possible benefactors or investors. "That's so far from 5 mil that it doesn't even count," he said. "Will you stop? It's a start, and a great one. These things take time. You have over a month to raise the money, and it always snowballs." When he decided to raise money using crowdfunding, she'd helped him with a lot of the research, even edited his plea for money. "I should have started it right away," he said. "I should have gone on TV shows. I could have said something and millions of people would have heard me." "They wouldn't let you, remember? The FBI didn't want you on TV."
"Well, they ain't got shit done," he said.
"Pilar Jimenez is probably partying every night, playing merengue on the violin to her family." "You have time," she repeated. "It hasn't even been a week. You've raised almost $30,000 a day. That's incredible."
"It's been almost a week. At this rate, it'll take me 5 months to raise 5 mil.
I have less than 5 weeks, and the comments are fucking me up." "Call Benson again," she said.
She was convinced that the insurance company was to blame. All it had to do was pay the ransom or pay out the insurance policy before the ransom date, and Ray would have his violin back. Simple. The insurance agent had tried to explain to both of them that the company had a strict policy not to pay ransoms and that there was also a waiting period before any payment would be issued, let alone the delay required by his family settlement. But Nicole told them that their strict policy about ransoms wasn't written anywhere in any of the paperwork. She checked. So now she hounded Ray to make them pay.
"It doesn't do any good to call them," he said. "They're not paying more than the $25,000 reward."
Benson was no help. Neither were the investors. Trying to convince wealthy investors to cough up some of their hard-earned cash to invest in a small percentage of a stolen Stradivarius violin wasn't quite as easy as it might sound, especially when Ray had no proof that the violin still existed. And of course these investors were savvy enough to understand the implications of the Marx's lawsuit. Even if Ray did get the violin back, he might not actually own it. He might have to give it to the Marx family. When the violin had been stolen, it had seemed that there were a half dozen very possible leads. Pilar, Ray's family, the Marx family. Pilar had turned out to be a dead end. Alicia had talked to her, then the FBI had flown down. She'd refused to say anything, and they could find nothing in her movements or actions to tie her to the lost violin. Ray's family continued to be scrutinized, Bill Soames reported, but their bank accounts remained consistent. Consistently low, Ray thought, and none of them had acted suspiciously. Until someone made a move or slipped up, nothing could be done against them. The Marx family, by their very existence, was the most frustrating. If they hadn't stolen the violin, they should have, and in any case, they should take the blame. That said, the Marxes had been very quiet since the theft. Their lawyer had never coughed up additional evidence of the Marxes' legal claim.
"Why should they?" Ray told Alicia, "since they already have the violin. Their niece is probably practicing on it right now."
Maybe the niece and Pilar Jimenez would start a chamber group. So Ray had lost faith in the FBI and in Benson's crack art detective, Alicia. If he was going to get the violin back, he was going to have to do it himself. He tried to find investors to pay the ransom, but the money hadn't materialized. So he tried to raise the money himself, spending an hour a day on his crowdfunding site, answering questions or reaching out to music lovers, violin aficionados, fan groups. By the first week of June, he'd raised $1.2 million. So he hit the talk shows. Going to New York seemed intrusive and would derail his daily practicing, so he reached out to the TV and radio producers he'd met over the past year and invited them to film him in Charlotte. Several syndicated radio shows aired interviews across America. The New York Times unveiled an enormous photo of him on the first page of the style section. By June 15th, the day before he was leaving for Moscow, he'd raised
$2,330,285, $1,349,775 from wealthy donors, $683,510 from crowdfunding, $52,000 from the bank.
Janice had taken out a second mortgage on her house and given him $245,000. His family had been disinclined to assist. Why would they? They'd get $5 million shortly. The Tchaikovsky competition loomed. Ray couldn't forget those millions of online viewers who would be watching the contest. All rabid classical music fans. Many wealthy. If half of them donated $1, he'd have the ransom money. Win or lose, gold medal or none, the Tchaikovsky competition, which he'd spent the last 8 months practicing for, took on a whole new meaning. It would be his road to recovering the violin. The longer he survived in the tournament, the more people would see him and, hopefully, want to contribute to the crowdfunding campaign. Ray couldn't wait to get to Moscow. Chapter 26. Day 32. Departure. On June 16th, the day that he, Nicole, and Janice were heading to Moscow, Ray was packing when Kim Wok called.
"Hey," she said, "glad I caught you."
"I leave in 3 hours," he said. "Please tell me you're calling with good news. The Marxists dropped their suit?"
"I wish," she said. "I'm actually calling with bad news. I wish I didn't have to tell you before you leave for the competition, but there's no way around it."
His heart hit his throat.
"What is it?"
"Is it them? The Marx family?"
"Yes," she said. "They've altered their claim. Since the violin has been stolen, allegedly through your negligence, they're now going after the insurance money. All $10 million. They're claiming it's theirs. Their lawyer sent a raft of paperwork over to me. I'll email it to you if you want to read it on the plane, but it's fine by me if you just want to wait until after you're back."
He slumped against the wall. "You know that the Tchaikovsky competition is supposed to be the biggest pressure cooker in the classical music world? I was reading over the guidelines last night. Before I head to Moscow, I'm supposed to get at least 8 hours sleep and not panic about all the music I'll be playing. There are websites with meditation suggestions. I'm pretty sure this whack-ass lawsuit isn't in their rules."
"Glad you haven't lost your sense of humor," she said. "There's one more thing. It's not hugely urgent, but I figure I might as well tell you."
He waited.
"The lawyer is asking that the original violin case be examined and documented, photographed, appraised, etc."
"Holy crap. Are you serious?"
"It's not a big deal," she said. "You just have to take it to a mutually agreed upon appraiser who'll photograph it and appraise it. Easy."
"Can I do it when I get back?"
"Of course," she said. "But I've talked to the attorney, and they're okay using the people who restored the violin in the first place. They may want a second opinion if they contest the value, but this feels a bit pro forma at this point. The case is probably only worth a couple $100s.
"So Jacob Fisher can do it?"
"Yes," she said. "If there's time, you can drop it off before you head to the airport. If not, you can take it after you get back. I'd love to get this sorted sooner rather than later, but in any case, that's all I need from you for the time being."
"Okay," he said. Ray had almost forgotten the case, stuffed in a garbage bag under his bed. Now he dug it out from under the bed, wiped the dust bunnies off the garbage bag, and carried it, still in the bag, to Jacob's for photographing.
"What a waste of time and money," Ray fumed as he tossed the case into the back of his car.
Whatever. Everything with the Marxes wasted his time and money. He should be getting used to it by now. He'd drop the case off with Jacob, since the shop was on the way to the airport. Part 6. Competition. Chapter 27. Day 33. The pre-qualifying round. Six stories of ornately clad windows glared at Ray as he emerged from the taxi. The Moscow State Tchaikovsky Conservatory brooded down, an enormous Greek Revival building with Ionic columns flanking an austere pediment. On the other side of the driveway, a colossal bronze statue of Pyotr Ilyich Tchaikovsky conducting a silent symphony gleamed in a small park, the reds and yellows of the roses, marigolds, and dozens of other flowers glowing in the late afternoon sunshine. Quite a sight for a black guy who'd never been out of America before. He'd made it. The Tchaikovsky competition. The Music Olympics. 10 days of arguably the most grueling performances in the classical music world. 360 candidates had been selected for the live pre-selection / qualifying round, with 60 each from the following categories: violin, cello, brass, piano, woodwind, and voice. 2 days from now, the numbers would be cut. There would be 25 violinists in the first round, then that number would whittle down to 12 in the second round, and finally to 6 in the third round. Only a handful of Americans had ever made it to the first round, and only one had actually won. Now, Ray vowed, it would be two. Nicole and Janice were back at the hotel. They'd flown over with him on the 16-hour flight, and they'd all staggered gratefully to their rooms at the flamboyant National Hotel near the city center. Despite his weariness, Ray was charged up. "I'm going to go over and register," he told Nicole. She was sitting on the bed in a daze.
"You want me to come? I'll come if you want."
"Nah." He grinned at her.
"You have a lie down, as they say on this side of the pond. I'll check out the Moscow hotties and report back."
He grabbed a taxi outside and went to check out his competition, not the Moscow women. Although, to be fair, there were several head-turning young women on the drive. The press photos of the conservatory's auditoriums were dauntingly impressive. Soaring ceilings vaulted over intricate plasterwork, rows of theater seats encircled perfectly proportioned half-moons of stages. Everything in the pictures gleamed gold and blue and white, stunning in its magnificence. Reality was, as usual, less enticing. Outside the main hall and the smaller performing halls, the classrooms, offices, and practice rooms were decidedly more run down and pedestrian. The stone floors and the off-white paint on the walls seemed slightly exhausted, just a bit grimy, as if the building had been waiting for an enormous hand wielding a mop dipped in a truckload of industrial-strength bleach to make it sparkle. The public glamour and private grubbiness made him feel welcome and immediately helped him get his bearings. Despite the Cyrillic signs everywhere, this place was similar to all the other theaters he'd played in over the past year. He felt similarly about the other competitors. Before he'd arrived, and even though he'd watched a lot of the internet footage of previous competitions, he'd somehow expected everyone to be wearing tuxedos or ball gowns and to be dignified and austere. He imagined a lot of bows and curtsies, the kissing of gloved hands. He knew, of course, that this was a competition for the young, but seeing many kids younger than himself, 17 or 18, dressed casually in jeans and sneakers, complaining about waiting in line or wondering if they could get a cup of coffee, made him feel like he belonged. He was as good as they were. No one was black, but he didn't expect that. Besides, he'd gotten used to being immediately distinguishable from the crowd. People knew who he was just by the color of his skin. When he'd first pulled open the enormous doors into the towering vestibule, He thought that the people were looking at him because he was the only black guy in the crowd. But when an older woman with tired blue eyes and a gentle handshake immediately approached him, telling him in a heavy French accent how sorry she was to learn about his strad, he realized that the head's turning had little to do with the color of his skin and everything to do with the loss of the violin. In minutes, he was surrounded. Dozens of hands reached out to pat him on the back, and he heard what he thought was sorry in dozens of languages. The crush of people scared him for a moment, but then he realized that this was his tribe. People whose lives centered around music, who would understand like no one else what losing his violin meant to him. He stood in line for registration. People were still constantly tapping him on the shoulder, talking to him in heavily accented English, Russian, or other Eastern European languages, or French, German, or Japanese. Sometimes he could distinguish only the words sorry or Stradivarius. Then he caught sight of not one, but two camera crews from Medici TV, which would circle the hall, streaming the performance live to its 5 million viewers. The lights were disorienting, casting unexpected shadows. He needed to be interviewed so he could appeal to its listeners to go to his crowdfunding site. As soon as he was registered, he'd introduce himself to one of the camera crews. Many kids had come with their parents, luggage in tow, straight from their flights. A tall, slender guy, two contestants ahead, carried a cello case. A Canadian bumper sticker with a maple leaf on it shone red and white against the black fiberglass. A tall Slavic woman with acne scars on her cheeks and a bloom of pimples on her chin said,
"Excuse me, you are Ray McMillan, yes?"
"Hey." "Yeah," Ray said, holding out his hand.
"Violin."
"And you are?"
"Svetlana Svatsolov." "Voice," she said. "So sorry to hear about your violin," she started.
And Ray got ready with his standard, "Thanks, I haven't given up hope," response. But she went on.
"My friends and I have bet that you would speak with Mikhail, and I won this bet. So thank you."
"What bet? Who's Mikhail?"
"My friends,"
she indicated the two girls with her,
"bet that you would speak to him, and I bet that you would not. I have won this bet, and they must take me to special dinner, so thank you."
He shook his head, bewildered. "I don't understand. Who's Mikhail? Why would I talk to him? Is he American?" She laughed, and her friends laughed, too.
"Mikhail Lizenkov,"
said the short, dark-haired girl next to Svetlana, like it was obvious.
"Mikhail Lizenkov from Serbia,"
she repeated, like maybe he was teasing her. Ray stared at her blankly.
"Sorry, miss, I'm not following you. Is he a judge?"
"He is. How do you say?"
They talked among themselves for a moment.
"He is your rival,"
Svetlana said. She fumbled with her phone, pulled up a page, handed it to him. It was in Cyrillic. He handed it back.
"I can't read this, and I honestly don't know what you're talking about."
The third girl was pulling up a translation. "Who will win the Tchaikovsky competition, America or Serbia?" He scanned the blog post. Apparently, cyberspace was taking bets about the outcome of the competition, and there were two crowd favorites, the Serbian Mikhail Lizenkov and the American Raekwon McMillan. He wasn't sure if he should be flattered, embarrassed, or surprised.
"I didn't even know about this," he said. "I haven't really been focusing on social media."
Ray had spent the last month online dealing with crowdfunding. He'd studiously avoided looking at the other potential competitors. For him, this was all about the music, about playing the best he could. And he knew that if he spent a lot of time studying other people who potentially would be competing against him, it would only undermine his confidence and psych him out. Besides, up until a few weeks ago, he'd had one advantage that none of the rest of them possessed: a magical violin that made every note sound perfect.
"Mikhail is right there,"
the dark-haired girl said, pointing with her chin.
"He keeps looking at you. You did not see?"
Ray hadn't noticed, but now he turned like a moron and locked eyes with a handsome blue-eyed blonde guy about his age standing in another line a few feet away.
Stop, Svetlana said, grabbing Ray's shoulder. Now he knows we are talking about him.
The damage was done. All Ray could do was give a cool, what's up nod and turn back to the group. I guess this hasn't really hit the States yet, he told them.
Are you going to talk to him?
Probably later, he said. He wished them luck. Only Svetlana was competing. The others were there for moral support. Said goodbye, and his turn came at the registration desk to pick up his badge and registration materials. Afterward, he'd planned on introducing himself to the Medici TV people, but a thought had struck him, and now he couldn't shake it loose. He wandered outside, thinking about Mikhail Lazenkov from Serbia. He tried out the name a few times. How awesome that he had a rival, that a bunch of strangers would create his own personal duel. Typical media hype. His brain felt like a Ferris wheel spinning, catching a glimpse of a farther shore, and then whirling on and down. He decided to walk back to the hotel since it wasn't far. He checked out a few shop windows as he passed, enjoying the exotic alienness of an early Moscow evening. Maybe he'd pick up the gorgeous silver filigree necklace set with blue-painted porcelain beads for Nicole. That amber bracelet in the next shop window would look really good on Aunt Rochelle. Mikhail Lazenkov from Serbia. He didn't have a lot of money left, especially with the Marx's lawsuit, but he thought a little splurging wouldn't hurt anybody. To celebrate his arrival in Moscow, he bought a sweet braided dough collage from a tiny bakery, ate it as he walked. Mikhail Lazenkov. He couldn't shake the name. It resonated, echoing. Now, a wild, irrational thought kept bouncing around his head. Could Mikhail Lazenkov have had anything to do with his Strad's theft? Of course not. Ray was seeing suspects everywhere. It was only natural. But he couldn't shake the possibility, and the more he mulled it over, the less irrational it seemed. He pulled out his phone and Googled Mikhail Lazenkov, but it was too hard to walk, eat, and read. Besides, the hotel was only a couple blocks away now. The blinds had been drawn in the hotel room. Nicole breathed, rhythmic and faint. He showered. She'd unpacked and left his toiletry bag in the bathroom. What a goddess. Slipped into bed, pulled up the website he'd been looking at on the street. The alleged rivalry between Lazenkov and Macmillan was all over the internet, on all social media channels that covered the Tchaikovsky competition, which, to be fair, were mostly European. But still, he hadn't touched social media for the past 6 months. He also never Googled himself. It was too weird. He wondered why nobody had mentioned this rivalry to him before, and he had a vague recollection of Nicole, or was it Janice, mentioning that one of the other competitors was really great, but honestly, he hadn't been paying much attention, caught up in the loss of the Strad and the pressure of practicing. So, Ray thought, let's just say that you're a young, ambitious Serbian violinist who everyone says is a shoe-in for winning the Tchaikovsky competition, except for one other competitor, some black dude who happened to luck into a Stradivarius. Without it, the black dude is just a really good player. With it, the Strad could put him over the top. Is it inconceivable to believe that you'd figure out a way to steal the violin? Find a housekeeper in a hotel where the black dude is staying, pay her a few $1,000s to take it? Ray was crazy, stupid, paranoid. He slipped out of bed, into the bathroom, texted Alicia. Ray, hi, I'm in Moscow. There's a Serbian violinist who people say is my big rival here, Mikhail Lazenkov. Google him. I just learned this a few minutes ago, or I would have said something sooner. You asked about people with a motive? He has a big one. Alicia,
just to win the competition?
I know it's a big deal, but is that really a motive?
Ray,
I seriously think it is. Can you at least check it out?
Alicia,
this is really interesting. There's a violin rumored to be for sale in Serbia. Black market. I was having contacts check it out, but it's one of several leads. Now we'll dig in more thoroughly, ASAP.
Ray,
there's a black market violin in Serbia? Seriously?
Alicia,
don't get your hopes up. I heard of violins for sale in Qatar and China, too.
He lay awake for another hour, vibrating with exhaustion, listening to Nicole's breathing, unable to stop thinking about Mikhail Lazenkov, those knowing blue eyes. Would his family steal the violin, sell it on the black market, and get the ransom money? And their son would win the competition to boot. Why hadn't Ray thought of it himself?
Finally, he wrapped himself around Nicole and at last fell asleep, not waking until the alarm went off 3 hours later. The day was slated for practice, with a schedule and practice room assigned before the pre-qualifying round the next day. But at the conservatory, all the musicians distracted him, and he ended up returning to the hotel and running his pre-qualifying program with Janice and Nicole. In the afternoon, he returned to the conservatory to look for Mikhail Lazenkov, but couldn't find him. He did find the Medici TV camera crews, however. The Russian classical music scene was on an entirely different level from America's. Both up-and-coming as well as established musicians held rock star status, primarily because Medici TV broadcasted all types of classical music performances: opera, small ensembles, choral, soloists, orchestras. The station's logos and banners were prominent in the hall and in the programs. An interview couch sat right inside the small auditorium's foyer. On it, a correspondent interviewed one of the piano contestants. Ray lingered. The young Japanese pianist batted her eyes at the camera and at the fans who loosely circled them. She was really excited to be playing the second Ravel piano concerto.
I feel the second movement will really speak to the souls of anyone who has ever been in love.
Okay, then. Sure. Here goes nothing, he thought.
He straightened his blue blazer, waded through a group of Russian and Asian fans, made eye contact with the interviewer as the pianist's interview concluded. The Japanese pianist was barely off the couch before the interviewer, a young woman with shaggy hair and round John Lennon-style glasses, was up and shaking his hand, her smile as wide as the couch she'd been sitting on.
Raekwon McMillan, welcome to Moscow. How are you feeling? Are you ready to take on the competition? Do you have a few moments? We'd love the chance to talk to you.
Ray was careful to smile as he shook her hand. The camera's enormous eye glittered at him, but he'd done his share of media interviews. After 60 minutes, this didn't seem particularly terrifying.
I'm really happy to be here. I'm so excited to be a part of the competition.
He was focused on the camera and the interviewer, but could sense the crowd around and behind him. People were gathering, listening.
Raekwon, you have such an interesting story, so inspiring and so heartbreaking.
Please, call me Ray.
We've all heard about the devastating loss of your instrument, but we'll get to that in a moment. What made you decide to enter this competition?
The trick, he knew, was to first make your audience sympathize with you. Then you could make the ask.
I've always loved music, he said. I've always loved playing. This is the most prestigious musical competition in the world. Of course I want to be part of it.
The world is glad you are a part of it. We have all been following your journey, which is so unconventional and so inspiring. No formal instruction until college, I believe? And you play at jazz clubs? How have you managed to balance these aspects and make it this far in the classical music world?
Ray talked about how music was a strong influence in his life, how he'd made music on a cheap school rental, how people surrounding him had supported him,
saw something in him that he hadn't even known existed. I learned to accept help and encouragement in every form it comes in, he said. The crowd let out a collective, aww. This was his chance. Which is why I'm hoping your viewers can help me. As you know, my violin was stolen a month ago. We've heard, so terrible, and it hasn't been recovered. No, it hasn't been recovered, yet. But your viewers can actually help. You may know that there's a $5 million ransom due in less than a month, July 15th. I don't have the money, but I'm trying to raise it myself. So part of the reason I'm here, part of the reason I'm actually competing, is to make an appeal to your listeners to help me get my violin back. How can we help? I'm doing everything humanly possible to raise the money. I know there are millions of people watching this competition right now. Imagine if 5 million of you sent me $1. I could pay the ransom and get my violin back. Everyone would have a chance to hear it. He looked directly at the camera, imagining that it wasn't a cold round lens, but the face of a little old black lady in a pink housecoat, her blue tinted hair and curlers. Please, he said, and the emotion was raw in his voice. Please help me get my violin back. My crowdfunding page is Ray's Fiddle. Please help me. Silence for a moment, both from the woman across from him and from the audience. Then the woman cleared her throat.
Well then, there you have it. A very heartfelt plea from the American violinist Ray McMillan for help in the return of his violin. Ray, will you join us again in the coming days to update us?
Ray leaned in and smiled.
Absolutely.
He spent the afternoon talking to audience members, providing further information about the violin, checking the GoFundMe page. The donations had immediately spiked by another $10,000 and were steadily increasing. He just needed it to go viral. Next day, after an early workout and a quick practice, Ray, Nicole, and Janice returned for the live pre-qualifying round, which started at 9:30 a.m. He caught sight of Mikhail Lezenkov, who appeared right before they all went off with their different groups to separate parts of the building for the next 5 hours. Ray had chosen a grueling 20-minute program, Tsagan and Dance of the Goblins, with Tchaikovsky's obligatory Serenade Melancolique thrown in. Janice tried to give him last-minute suggestions backstage, but he didn't really hear her. He was itching to be in front of the orchestra, show them what he could do. He was in a group of 15, performing for judges and a packed audience of rabid music lovers who stomped and cheered for each contestant. As he stepped onto the stage, the press in the balcony lifted cameras, the audience clapped and held up phones to record him. The air was electric. The crowd thundered. He couldn't believe that even in this pre-selection round, there would be an audience of such rabid classical music fans. Marathon runners trained for months, gradually building up endurance and strength, both mental and physical, to withstand hours of running. A few weeks before the race, they taper down to shorter, easier runs, scaling back on their mileage to be fresh for race day. All Ray knew at the start of the competition was that he hadn't really picked up his violin to play seriously for well over a week. He hadn't the heart, so he'd focused on the theft and trying to raise money for the ransom. And then there was the travel to Moscow. So now, as he jumped into his beloved Tsagan, which he'd practiced endlessly for the past 6 months, he was playing it fresh. The gypsy themes, light and bold, poured from the violin, and he threw himself into its lushness. The 10 minutes of Ravel flew by, and then he was on to the Bazzini, and all too soon Tchaikovsky's wistful, elegant Serenade Melancolique. He realized only when he had finished that it was over. He bowed, and the crowd again roared approval, palms hammering against armrests and feet stomping. He'd never played for such an enthusiastic audience before. Despite the pressure, it really was fun. He gave a thumbs up to the judges, and the crowd collectively lost their shit, as he told Janice afterward. That evening, the judges read out the names of the 25 performers who were officially competitors, and the next day would begin the first round. Ray was one of them. So was Mikhail Lezenkov. The competition had begun.